Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is Speaking Freely. I'm Annette Newell. My guest, Betsy Johnson, candidate for Oregon governor.
I'm a native Oregonian. I came from a family where public service was valued and practiced. I grew up in Central Oregon. My father was in the timber business, and both my parents were heavily involved in issues of state-level interest. My father served in the legislature for 7 terms, and then he was the mayor of Redmond in his 2nd term at the time of his death. My mother served bipartisan governors on the State Board of Higher Education and other education policy commissions and boards. I went away to school, came back to go to law school, worked for the Multnomah County Courts for 4 years, spent a lot of time in the jail, which gave me a pirate-like vocabulary, graduated from law school the day the Trailblazers won the championship, pretty much knew I didn't want to practice law, so it was serendipitous that I was invited to be a member of the United States helicopter team and fly in Europe and the Soviet Union. I departed to go do that, came back from flying abroad, and started a helicopter company out in Scappoose. Our little company motto was, "Your wallet, we haul it." We did all sorts of things with helicopters. Took bad bears out of the national parks, built power lines across ecologically sensitive parts of Arizona, fought fire, made movies, did all sorts of things. But probably the most interesting was for 10 years, we were the prime contractor to the U.S. Geological Survey. I flew the day of the eruption. I've landed in the crater numerous times. We set all the original seismometers up there and then helped with the recovery and the reforestation. And so we were very active on Mount St. Helens for a decade. Had the opportunity to sell the company, did, ran for the House, was elected 3 times to the Oregon House of Representatives. 10 days into my 3rd term, the senator was appointed to a remunerative position, and 23 county commissioners, 5 sets of county commissioners, unanimously selected me to fill out her term. And then since 2005, I earned election to that seat. I represented Senate District 16, which is Tillamook, Clatsop of Columbia, a little bit of Washington, a little bit of Multnomah County. I represented that district until December of last year when I resigned to focus full-time on running for governor. And I think what has motivated me right straight along was I'm an Oregonian, and it gives me no pleasure at all to say my beloved state is in a tailspin. We've got the most unpopular governor in the nation. Our streets are awash in drugs and crime and violence. Our schools are graduating kids who can't read. I just couldn't sit by any longer and allow a state I love to deteriorate at the rate that it was going. I've been a Republican. I've been a Democrat. Both of those parties got so extreme, I ended up divesting myself of any political affiliation so that I could be true to Oregonians. And what motivates me is a track record of fixing things. I believe that any of my colleagues in the legislature would say our office had an earned respect and an earned track record of bringing people together to work on really complicated problems like flood recovery. I have liked doing that work. I think I do it well, and I wanted to bring that experience, capability, and desire to bring Oregonians together to start focusing on how do we get our maverick spirit back and make Oregon a place we're all proud to call home again.
What are you most proud of legislatively accomplishing as an Oregon lawmaker and as a state senator?
I was a budget writer, and I've taken great pride in the fact that we've delivered good budgets. But the thing I'm the most proud of is the service to the citizens of Senate District 16. We never said, are you a Democrat or a Republican? If you lived in Senate District 16, and sometimes beyond those boundaries, if colleagues invited me to be helpful in their districts, but if you were a constituent in Senate District 16, we helped you. I've helped people get insulin, false teeth. One of my prized possessions is a letter I got in 2008 when the whole mortgage crisis was occurring. A little girl sent me a Christmas card that said, "We kept our house for Christmas because of you." I met a family down in Tillamook that I facilitated their adoption of a child and got this child out of the foster care system. I helped found the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center, a consortia of business, academia, government, and we've added philanthropy as the fourth leg on our stool. We're putting five kids with the help of philanthropy through an undergraduate program at Oregon Tech. Meanwhile, helping businesses de-risk the acquisition of research and development equipment. We're working with OSU, PSU, Oregon Tech, and Portland Community College. I help facilitate the building of a PCC campus right next to OMIC, the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center. We are working on research and development projects that make business deliver manufactured products, particularly in the heavy metal space, cheaper, faster, lighter, greener, better, and are working with 40 companies that are global marquee companies, European companies, Asian companies, that introduce new techniques and technologies to Oregon manufacturing. And then I certainly am proud of the role that I played in facilitating the conversion of the abandoned Wapato Jail into the Bybee Lakes Hope Center, which is now a place of recovery, reintegration, hope. These are people that have been homeless, drug or alcohol addicted, and they have come to a place of healing and hope. I helped found that facility. I don't take credit for the not-for-profit that runs it. That's run by a very capable guy named Alan Evans, who's been a friend for two decades. Alan spent a long time on the streets, addicted to meth, and then in and out of the penitentiary. Alan, based on his personal experience, wanted to help other addicted adults. He's doing so, and we have been doing it. I don't have a plan. I have an action. I have been out helping Bybee Lakes succeed since it took over the facility just before the pandemic. We now are bringing people in off the streets, giving them the hope of recovery with wraparound services, navigation through all of the different things that have put them on the streets, whether it's mental illness, whether it's domestic violence, poverty. We're trying to help Oregonians get back on their feet and live productive and healthy lives. I have participated in crafting some powerful budgets that brought the power of the state of Oregon to bear all over the state of Oregon. I was very ecumenical in advocating for investment in every corner of our state. Those are the things that I'm the most proud of. We were a very people-centered office and provided that shock absorber between just ordinary Oregonians and the state of Oregon.
Our state really got flooded with COVID relief cash. Was that money managed well?
I think that in our effort to push that money out, that we maybe weren't as aggressive or thorough with due diligence. One that Tina Kotek and I have sparred over regularly is a thing called Project Turnkey. It was the state acquiring motels to house people. I was a hawk about making sure those acquisitions were fiscally sustainable and that the state wasn't out just buying somebody else's problem. Many of those motels had failed as a result of COVID. In the main, do I think it's a good idea to house people in abandoned motels? Yeah, sure. But how much is it going to cost to put a new roof on it, to put kitchens in what were hotel rooms so that people could actually live there? And Tina manages to suggest that I thought that was a bad idea. I didn't think it was a bad idea. I just wanted to make sure that it was fiscally viable. That same program has failed in parts of California. Already the not-for-profits that took over these properties are back nibbling away at the general fund in California. I asked some pretty tough questions about Project Turnkey. The state was so unable to get these big projects out and on the street that we outsourced the administration of Project Turnkey to the Oregon Community Foundation. Now, I think that's fine. Max Williams, who was their president during the time that we did this, is not only a friend, a former legislator, a very capable attorney, but he ran the Oregon Community Foundation with skill and compassion. Still, leadership in the Capitol was so uncertain Oregon could deliver this COVID relief money that we outsourced it to a private sector organization to make sure that it got done. That's another reason that I'm running. Government is not deliberate. State government has never been as well fed as it is right now and is just failing to show up when Oregonians need it. The COVID money, I think at the end of the day, if there are some audits, we're not going to do real well on some of those audits.
What did COVID teach us about the state of health care in Oregon?
How fragile it is. COVID is still teaching us that lesson. Our hospitals are overwhelmed. And oh, by the way, because of Tina Kotek's lackadaisical approach to drugs, a lot of our hospital beds are taken up with ODs and overdoses and people that simply can't cope with their drug addiction. The COVID experience, I think, should have taught all of Oregon how fragile our hospital system is. We've had to import nurses, referred to as travelers, that are paid considerably more than the very durable long-term workforce in our hospitals. That inequity has caused morale problems. It's been obvious that we just worked people to death during COVID, and because of the episodic and contradictory information coming out of the Oregon Health Authority, many of those nurses found themselves not only clinicians at the bedside, but they were also grief counselors. When the family couldn't come in to hold the hand of their dying loved one, that obligation fell to nurses. Enormous strain was put on our medical professionals, doctors, nurses, NPs. We're going to pay the price for that for a long time. Many of our hospitals, especially rural hospitals, and I have three of them in my old legislative district, those rural hospitals are financially struggling. I believe it's going to take a long time, especially for the rural medical community, to recover.
How would you help Oregon's kids catch up on their pandemic learning losses?
First, let's talk about what caused a lot of this. The single worst thing that we did during the pandemic was to close the schools. We got scores that showed that our kids are not anywhere close to where they should be at accomplishment for their grade level. And just day before yesterday or a couple days ago, we got the ACT test scores back. We have cheated Oregon kids. It's going to take a long time for us to recover. We now are beginning to see how we've hurt our kids academically because we're getting the test scores back. We have no clear measure that I've seen for their social emotional deterioration or their mental health deterioration. For some kids who didn't have Leave It to Beaver kind of families, and now I've dated myself by quoting a TV show that's as old as Leave It to Beaver, but if they didn't have Ward and June Cleaver, those kids were just abandoned for 2 years. We have done tremendous damage. So my solution is we have to augment remedial teaching staff, assuming we can find them, to put in the schools to try to bring our kids back up to grade level. And what's exacerbating that problem is Oregon has become unaffordable except for the very wealthy, whether it's teachers, police officers, mental health experts. It's impossible to recruit people to places where there is either no housing or no affordable housing. The neglect of Oregon that has occurred during the years of the Kate Brown Tina Kotek administration has left us with a housing shortage, schools that are being run by the teachers' unions rather than the classroom teachers and parents and school boards, left our kids in academic deficit, not to mention social, emotional, and mental health deficit. We've got to triage fixes to get our kids back up to grade level and focus on the core competencies. Kate Brown and Tina put through a bill that functionally turns a high school diploma into a participation certificate. Our kids can't demonstrate competency in core subjects, reading, writing, and arithmetic. And we've gotten so carried away with worrying about everybody's pronouns, we forgot that they can't add, they can't spell, they can't read. We have grossly cheated our kids. And I believe that it is an Oregonian responsibility to do everything we can to remediate the damage that we've done to those kids.
What are your ideas to alleviate domestic violence?
I think some of it is the paucity of mental health care professionals throughout our whole state. There is no psychiatrist in Clatsop County, for example, right now. The legislature and to a greater degree the federal government under John F. Kennedy said that if we brought people out of institutions that they could get community care. We never came through with the community care. And so again, 2 years of forced isolation and COVID has driven our domestic violence problems and intensity to a breaking point. We need to have people have access to accessible, affordable mental health care. I think that probably drinking and drug use has accelerated the instances of domestic violence. As governor, I would do everything I could to ask the legislature to re-refer ballot measure 110 to the ballot and to have an honest conversation with Oregonians about what legalizing hard drugs has done in this state. I voted against that measure. I campaigned against that measure. Once the voters of Oregon, because it was a ballot measure, once the voters of Oregon had approved it, I thought the state ought to get to work on implementing it. The state has failed miserably. They've just pushed the first tranche of money out. I don't know what degree of rigor was applied to whether or not the recipients of this federal money, and it's going to approach $1 billion, whether or not these are programs that have a track record of efficacy in dealing with the problems. But again, it's not just COVID. It is drug use and alcoholism and the fact that Oregon ranks 50th in the state in terms of our ability to deal with mental health. And so much of the domestic violence is driven by poverty, drugs, alcohol, forced isolation with COVID, and certainly the inflation that is going to, I think, continue to exacerbate the domestic violence problem as families struggle to put food on the table. And often when they are unable to deal with domestic issues within a tranquil household, that boils over.
Betsy, you got some huge campaign contributions, notably from Phil Knight. What do you think about the influence of money in politics?
Let's be honest. Everybody wants to concentrate on the private money. Let's talk about the $1 million that the public sector unions gave Tina Kotek. If we're going to do anything about money in politics, it has to be fair. The unions can't continue to pour money in to buy elections, the public sector unions, and muzzle everybody else. The fact of the matter is I've known Mr. Knight. He's a friend. We've known each other socially. Mr. Knight is a great Oregonian, born here, educated here, started a world-class company here, employs thousands of Oregonians, could have left this place but didn't. With his private philanthropy, he's working to cure cancer at both the University of Oregon and OHSU, the Oregon Health and Sciences University. I am thrilled an Oregonian of his stature and his mindset is in my corner.
Let's talk about the drought and the wildfires. What are some of the solutions that you would want to try to implement there?
Well, let me start by touching on what I think my bona fides are to have an opinion about this. If I'm not the first, I am very close to the top. I think I'm the first woman to be certified to carry a water bucket under a helicopter. The guy from the Federal Aviation Administration that was supposed to check me out wouldn't fly with me because I was a girl. I'm still cranky about that. I had a company that worked on forest fires. I've been out on the fire lines many times. I grew up in Central Oregon, very aware of the danger of forest fire. And even now, as an adult, I don't really exhale until it rains hard in Central Oregon. One of the things that Oregon is uniquely qualified to do is to manage our forests better. It's a principal obligation of state government. Don't let the place burn down on our watch. When I build my new budget as the governor, to make sure that we've got adequate air assets and adequate boots on the ground to fight fire. Oregon has an earned reputation nationally and internationally of doing what's called initial attack. When a fire is very small, less than 10 acres, we hit it hard and fast and put it out. The feds don't have that same firefighting philosophy. They dither and they do environmental assessments and they look around and they think about fire. In the meantime, while they're thinking about what habitat might be damaged, the habitat is burning up. So we've got to get harmonized with the feds about our approach to fighting fire. The lawsuits are still going to be coming in about the federal mismanagement of the Lion's Head and the Beachy Creek fire up in the San Ynon Canyon. Those court cases may lay bare some of the flaws in how we harmonize firefighting with our federal partners. We've got to get a coherent forest management. We've taken a lot of the roads out of our forest as a result of federal policy, and that makes it harder to fight fire. We have got to be able to manage our forests in a way that gets the debris off the ground. We need to thin. We need to prescriptively burn. We need to actively manage our forests and stop turning them into inaccessible areas that continue to be tinder dry. We need to salvage logs. Having those stands of trees that were burned just waste while they're standing on the ground is almost criminal. We ought to cut them down, see what beneficial use can be made of the burned lumber, and then reforest as fast as we could. The example is the Tillamook Forest that burned multiple times over a number of years was actively reforested and is now a verdant, thriving forest. And then last but not least, we've got to use our powerhouse research universities to continue to develop techniques that let us manage fire better. Drones that can be used inside a fire or on the fire line. Early warning, smoke detection. I'm very pleased, again, to say that OSU is one of the partners at the Oregon Manufacturing Innovation Center. And while to the best of my knowledge, we don't have any fire suppression projects going right now, I hope we do because the talent in our research universities could be brought brought to bear on how we more effectively and efficiently fight fire.
When it comes to homelessness, I know you talked about the Wapato Jail project. What else needs to be done? That seems to be the issue that comes up again and again with Oregonians, as that's their most critical problem.
Well,
in our state, is housing insecurity and homelessness.
Because it's so obvious. Just go out on any street and you're going to see the tent. I think we've been doing an absolutely crappy job. We haven't used the power of law enforcement. There has been no sense of urgency about getting people off the streets. The Office of Homeless Services has purchased 6,000 tents and God knows how many tarps that now we're scraping off the streets. The waste in that is just incalculable. We have not had a sense of urgency. On the day after the election, when I'm the governor, I'm going to convene the requisite people to talk about how do we instill a sense of urgency. Christine wants to declare an emergency. Portland's declared 6 already, and you just need to walk outside to see that we've got an emergency. Various lawsuits have been filed. There's a new one that now cites ADA, Americans with Disability, and the fact that people who have limited sight or need mobility devices are being forced out into the streets to get around the tent. We have allowed a proliferation of crime to develop. There's a pretty significant criminal element living on the streets right now. They ought to be arrested. They ought to be investigated. They ought to be indicted, and Mike Schmidt ought to prosecute them and prosecute them aggressively, because some of the people living on the streets are preying on others more vulnerable that are also living on the streets, and I think we've done precious little to deal with that. There are rules on the books about camping on public streets. I find it fascinating with the advent of President Biden coming to Portland. I'll be interested to see how many of Tina's tent city they clean up so that Portland doesn't look so bad when President Biden is here. When he came the last time, they cleaned up a big swath of Marine Drive that he was going to drive by to make sure that it didn't look as urban decay as it looked prior to his arrival. So as far as I'm concerned, he could come once a week for the next 4 weeks if that helps urge Portland to get cleaned up. But I think the thing that's been missing right straight along is a plan with deliverables, timelines, budgets, and people who will actually discharge the responsibility. I don't think it's a lack of money, because especially in Multnomah County, where all of these additional taxes have been passed, people want to know, I'm paying all this money, why is my street still a mess? Why are there syringes in the parks? Why are there people defecating in doorways? Why is this happening? And where is the sense of accountability? So I would gather all of the requisite people, addiction specialists, mental health specialists, law enforcement, get a very quick list of assigned tasks. Attach realistic budgets to those tasks, and then hold people accountable to deliver on discharging whatever the task is. Because right now we are proliferating not-for-profits that are pondering homelessness, thinking about homelessness, adding costs with their administrative overhead. I want to get a baseline so we know what's the profile of the people on the streets, how many people are on the streets, and then some actual measurables that could be shared with Oregonians who are picking up the financial bill for all of this, that we have actually moved people off the streets into productive lives in a durable and sustainable way. It's not going to be good enough to be off the streets for 2 days and sober for 2 weeks. We got to actually make a difference in the lives of Oregonians that are suffering on the streets. It is not humane to proliferate these tent cities. And legislation that Tina Kotek has passed has made it harder to remove the tent cities rather than to do something about it.
Another big crisis point in Oregon and Portland has been the shootings. 2021, we saw Portland's most ever shootings and murders, 1,200 documented shootings, nearly 70 homicides with guns. We're on track to beat that this year. You're a gun owner and you're proud of it. What needs to be done to lessen this gun violence? Are there types of gun control that you would support?
Sure. Let's start with that. I think we ought to move the age to buy certain weapons from 18 to 21. I think we ought to do much more rigorous background checks, including allowing the schools to provide information into a record that would say little Johnny is writing very dark emails or has threatened his school colleagues. We too often find out about some of the problems that student has had way after the fact of a shooting. Along with that background checks comes hardening the schools in terms of putting school resource officers in the schools, putting mental health experts in the schools, school nurses, those trusted adults that a young person could come to if they're suffering some kind of a mental crisis. The main thing we we've got to do is to keep guns out of the hands of criminals, mentally ill people, and kids. Then the other thing that I want to call people's attention to is the fact that right now going on in Portland is a racketeering trial. It has to do with gangs that are proliferating in Portland, and these gangs are frequently walking around armed to the teeth because part of their rite of passage is a certain level of violence. I think that that trial is going to be very interesting in allowing Oregonians to realize that there is a profoundly criminal element. And these guys are not much worried about where they're getting guns. There are plenty of illegal guns on the street, and these young criminals and gang members are out carrying them and killing each other. That's a clarion call for greater law enforcement. And instead of the legislature tying the hands of law enforcement to deal with some of these perpetrators, we ought to be freeing up and encouraging our police. The legislature, I had already left, but they passed a bill, 1510, that prohibits officers from stopping cars for minor infractions like taillights. I understand the argument on both sides that there has been abuse in that arena. There has been some profiling, and I am not sympathetic to that at all. Conversely, I would ask your listeners to think of the number of times that cars have been stopped, and in those cars are huge amounts of illegal drugs, generally huge amounts of guns, and the guns being owned or held by felons in possession of weapons that shouldn't have them. There's a role for law enforcement. I think we've got to get past this just gun or no gun debate and begin thinking about what are some of the other systemic causes of gang violence and what we can do to try to ameliorate criminals, kids, and the mentally ill coming into possession of weapons.
The Bend Source came out with an editorial today. I'm going to read part of it to you. While we enjoy the idea of a governor who's free of the pressures of party politics, that's not what we imagine politics in Salem would look like. Betsy Johnson jumped into this race to be a punch in the gut to the two parties, but in reality, she hasn't shown her case to be strong enough to end up being anything but a spoiler, potentially pushing Oregon into what we consider an alarming direction. Your rebuttal.
Well, my rebuttal is I haven't read the Bend Source argument. I find their premise specious when I watch other people now abandoning party politics. Dulcie Gabbard just announced she was abandoning the Democrats because of their very radical views on things. I still think that what I'm hearing from Oregonians, whether it's on the doorstep or whether it's at events, is that the acrimony of the fighting between the two parties has paralyzed our state. And that people are hungry to not have this kind of divisiveness. I actually believe from spending a lot of years in the legislature that there are R's and D's who want to work together, but they have been driven apart by the tribalism of their party politics. You know, if you work across the aisle, you're a bum because you got to ride for the brand regardless of how dumb the brand's ideas are. And that goes for both the R's and the D's. I believe that there is a hunger among Oregonians. We've attracted bipartisan support from all kinds of folks. Former Democrat Governor Ted Kulongowski has endorsed my candidacy. He did that simultaneously with the United States Senator Gordon Smith, a guy that is a Republican and will stay a Republican, but they have said, we're going to put aside our partisan alliances because we believe Oregon needs a better way. Margaret Carter, former head of the Democrat, and Herman Bertschinger, former head of the state Republicans, have also endorsed me. And these are people that have been part of the process and have witnessed the paralysis of party politics. I truly think that there are R's and D's who would welcome an opportunity to get back to a more balanced approach. Having the vote to ram through a bill is not synonymous with good legislation. I remain committed to the idea that Oregonians want their lawmakers at whatever level to work together to stop toadying political agendas and to worry about what's best for Oregonians.
Bottom line here, though, Betsy, if you end up splitting the Democratic vote with Tina Kotek and the end result is that Christine Drazen becomes governor, is that a direction that's favorable for Oregon, in your opinion?
Christine has some interesting ideas. Tina has some interesting ideas. Oregonians will decide at the ballot box. I am not in this as a spoiler. I am in this because I think I would be the best governor. I believe that at the start. Christine came into the race after I did. She and I had the back channels open for a little while. We talked to each other, and she had said consistently she wasn't going to run for governor. Now, while I profoundly disagree with her on some issues, she and I agree on some. Either way, substituting a Democrat extreme for a Republican extreme is no change at all. I believe that I'm offering the most profound change, and I believe it's a change that Oregonians are really, really hungry for.
You're listening to Speaking Freely. If you have a topic you'd like to hear about on the show, send an email to Annette.Newell@alphamediausa.com. Be sure to tune in again next week.